Well, welcome to Week, the political roundtable from the Commonwealth Club of California for Monday, November 3rd, 2014. Thanks for joining us today in San Francisco. I'm John Zipperer, the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial, and your host for Week to Week. On today's program, we're going to look at the month's local, state, and national elections, what's ahead for an expected change in control of Congress, the visit by a controversial comedian to Berkeley, you might have been following that story, the after effects of Ferguson on our political landscape, and more. So as usual, any comments expressed by us are those solely of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club of California. Let's meet our panelists for today. We're going to start on the far end there with Dr. Tammy Frisbee. She's a research fellow at the Hoover Institution and a lecturer in the Department of Political Science at Stanford University. Next to her is Josh Richmond, the state and national politics reporter for the Bay Area News Group. He's also a political blogger at ibabuzz.com. And next to me is Deborah J. Saunders, a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, who also writes the Token Conservative blog at sfgate.com. You can also follow them on Twitter, and you can follow the Commonwealth Club on Twitter, of course, at CWClub. So there are question cards throughout the room. Please write down and submit your questions, and I will do my best to get as many asked as possible during our program. Now, on to the roundtable. Tomorrow, of course, is Election Day, and it is widely expected to be a very strong day for congressional Republicans. Both parties have been obsessing about this for months. The Democrats, I believe, even made a campaign film about Election Day. It's called The Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day. I think it's a horror film. Meanwhile, Republicans have been talking up what they will do if they once they control both houses of Congress. So I wanted to start there. I'm going to start with Tammy, actually. Who do you think, assuming the Republicans actually take control of the Senate, which pretty uncontroversial, I think, to say at this point, what individual politicians do you think are going to be, if you will, in the ascendant? Who's going to perhaps be new majority leaders or vying for those leadership positions within the party?
Sure. First thing I'd say is that a month ago, it didn't seem so certain. And so it's in these weeks leading up to Election Day, we are seeing evidence in the polls that there has been this shift toward the Republicans. I noted with interest that I think this morning Gallup announced that they weren't, for the first time in decades, going to do a generic congressional ballot, which I have to do a little bit more reading about why you wouldn't do that, especially in a race that we've seen unfold the way it has. But certainly a month ago I would have said I thought the Senate could very well be 50-50 with Vice President Biden casting the deciding votes on controversial issues. But now it does seem like in Iowa, for example, Jody Ernst is pulling ahead. Tom Cotton in Arkansas seems to be pulling away from Mark Pryor. There's been a turn of events in favor of Cory Gardner in Colorado in that Gardner-Udall race. I have some questions about whether the polling is as accurate as some people believe it is. There's, of course, a question about the role that women voters are going to play in this midterm election, and women turn out historically at higher rates than men, even in midterm elections. So we'll have to see what those turnout effects are, but I would think that even if the numbers aren't quite what the polls are showing right now, that, yeah, the momentum is headed in Republicans' favor. So in terms of rising stars, then, to tie into some of those races I just listed off, I'd say that Tom Cotton, who is already in the House and is seen as an emerging star in the Republican Party, would be put on a rocket ship if he were to win that Senate seat in Arkansas. Jody Ernst has certainly gotten a lot of attention for her campaign ads, her hog castration approach. So we'll see.
Wait, she has a hog castration in the ads?
In the ads. Well, yes.
Best ad of the year.
Yes, because she has actually castrated hogs on a farm. And both of those two politicians are veterans, as is Gardner. So that would also be an interesting shift that right now we have John McCain as the head of the hawkish wing of the Republican Party. And so you could have Cotton and Ernst and Gardner, who didn't serve in Vietnam, but instead served in the wars that are so much on Americans' minds these days in Iraq and Afghanistan. So I think that they could really become ascendant if they do manage to pull off victories tomorrow.
Josh, who's likely to take most advantage, I guess, of the vote tomorrow?
Who's likely to take most advantage of it?
Or what? Personally, to get more power, who are we likely to hear more about as a result of that? Because the next question eventually will be, who's going to take the fall for it? And that might be a bit more of a fun conversation. But
well, you know, this is shaping up to look very much like a second presidential term midterm, you know, where the other party does well. And, you know, I think some of the blame will be laid at the president's feet. Certainly a lot of candidates have been running as fast as they can away from the president as this campaign has gone on. But that said, I'm not really convinced it's going to have a lot of sticking power. You know, I think if the Republicans do take control right now, you're going to see not a lot of change, not a lot of progress in any measurable sort of way in the next 2 years over what we've seen in the last two, four, six, or 8 years. The Democrats will wield their filibuster power in the Senate. The president will get out the veto pen if anything actually makes it to his desk. And in a way, I think that can actually benefit the president going into benefit the president's party going into the 2016 elections, because he becomes sort of the last bulwark of his party's beliefs. You know, he gets to be the hero to his party in protecting Obamacare from repeal if that bill should make it to his desk. The Republicans won't have enough votes to override his vetoes, so that's sort of, you know, another loggerheads kind of situation for the next couple of years. And then we have bigger turnout in 2016, which usually favors Democrats a little bit. It's going to be a more advantageous Senate electoral map in that year.
Meaning which seats are open.
Which seats are open. So, you know, as with any sort of midterm election, this too shall pass.
Deborah, much ado about nothing?
Besides
being very happy, I think, perhaps.
I'm not allowing myself to believe that the Republicans are going to take back the Senate, because my heart's been broken too many times before. And there's, you know, Dems are so great at organization and getting out the vote. So there's a part of me that I'll believe it when I see it. I realize that all the major pollsters are giving huge, having things lean in that favor, but I'm just not going to go there. But let's say it happens. Two things are going to happen. Mitch McConnell is really chomping at the bit to lead the Senate. And we know that Harry Reid held a lot of things back. There were not a lot of votes. I think you're going to see a Mitch McConnell who wants to push through some bills and get some things to the president's desk. That means they also have to get through the House afterward. Mitt Romney was on, I think.
That's okay.
Yeah. Okay, Mitt Romney was on Fox News, and he said he thinks that the Republicans will pass an immigration bill that is passable, not just something that can make it through the Senate, is what he meant, but something that could get through both houses and come before the president. And it's funny, because Ro Khanna, Democrat running against Mike Honda's, called for the same thing. Let's do a few things that are doable, and let's not let the perfect to some people be the enemy of the good.
So we're talking about a non-comprehensive immigration bill, sort of
a small bill.
A tweak here, a tweak there.
Something, maybe a DREAM Act, maybe not. Maybe H-1B visas, maybe farm workers, but not a path to citizenship. Mm. I think that's really passable. And the question for Latino voters is, do you want to have Democrats pass bills that will never, ever be enacted so that they can keep your issue in play forever?
And just to stay on that, you could see President Obama signing it just to get some immigration bill during his term.
He could, if that gets through the nature I'm talking about, and of course there could be problems in the House.
Sure.
But if that happens, I think it'd be very difficult for the president to not sign it. And we've seen how he gets heckled by DREAM Act kids all the time now and everything else.
So are the other Democratic candidates now.
That's right. I think one of the people we're really going to see become more powerful, whatever happens in the Senate, is Rand Paul. He just has a sense of where the party can find new voters, and he's really fascinating. He's moderated some of his foreign policy positions. I see him being somebody to watch, and perhaps my heart talking more than my brain. I think Ted Cruz is going to be someone who is going to be in less favor, because Republicans, To the extent that Republicans win, it's because they don't have the loose cannons in the races that really hurt, that had a domino effect hurting other Republicans. And I think that after what happened in the House when, you know, he tried to defund Obamacare, I think that sort of those antics will be out, and that people will be looking for less drama in the Republican Party.
What about on one of our other week-to-week programs, Dr. Larry Gersten, one of our frequent panelists, said that if the Democrats lose their Senate majority, that, if you will, the long knives will be out for Harry Reid, among other Democrats. Do you guys agree with that? Do you think that basically there's been... anyone, of course, who's in that position for a long time is going to develop some antagonisms, whether it's just from people who want the position or people who have disagreed with where he's taken the hot chamber for a while. But do you think there's anything?
He's out. If he loses the Senate, and here's the thing, people here get used to seeing Nancy Pelosi lose elections and still hang on to the leadership position. That's not the way politics usually work, right? So here you might think, gee, would that happen? But he has put his party, I mean, everyone in the media talks about how extreme the GOP is. He has made his party so incredibly extreme that he's made life very difficult for moderate Democrats. And I think that there will be, if he loses the Senate, he's out. Because I don't care how much money he's raised, I think he's just out, and people will think it's time. And the fact that he would not have votes on so many things. I think it was in Politico today. There are all these Democrats and people, their opponents could say, you voted with the president 97% of the time. That's because there were so few votes, because there were so many appointments that weren't voted on and other things like that where moderate Democrats could have shown their independence.
So if Harry Reid's out as leader, then minority leader, if you will, who's chomping at the bit to take that? Who are some of these other, Tammy?
Well,
you see,
I think that Harry Reid can hold on to it if the other Democrats can't coalesce around a candidate, and I think that is what is fairly plausible, is that he might get it by default, either because or a combination of the other Democrats in the Senate not being able to decide who to vote for, and some Democrats, maybe some strategic politicians, wanting to hang back and not have their fingerprints on the next couple of years, because while I am not overly optimistic about the capacity of the Republicans in the Senate to govern effectively, it's actually good to sit here with people who think that this isn't a slam dunk for the Republicans going into 16 taking back the Senate, because I think they should be awfully nervous about the old adage that, you know, to whom much is given, much is expected. It may just be that some Democrats who have a little longer time horizon than the next 2 years in the Senate will decide that they want to hang back, let this dumpster fire, as I like to say, play out, and then maybe step forward in 2016 with potentially a Democrat in the White House and reclaiming the majority in the Senate.
And do you think Harry Reid changes? Or do you think we still have the same Harry Reid, if that's the case?
Same Harry Reid.
Harry Reid. So basically nothing happens.
Yes.
2 more years of nothing.
Yes. That would be my expectation. My greatest hope, and it's purely from a process policy wonk view, I don't think it helps the Republicans in 2016 because it's a very Washington issue. Best case scenario is that if the Republicans have control of the House and control of the Senate, that they can then use that authority to actually pass budgets and have regular budget order and have regular appropriations bills in which we say in advance that this is how much money the government is going to spend for the next fiscal year. But those are the kind of things that excite people like me, not voters.
No more life by continuing resolution?
Right.
What would we do?
Yeah. Yeah. No more government shutdowns, at least temporarily. That'd be nice.
Okay. I guess in this new, this new era that everyone's saying is going to be just like the other era, is there any chance for income tax reform? Is that something that the Republicans would want?
I don't hear a lot of people talking about it on the campaign trail. I mean, you know, there's
The president has said from time to time, oh, gee, that's something we could really do.
And well, he has, but I think you'd sooner see corporate and maybe capital gains tax reform before you'd get to income tax reform. I don't see that happening.
And I don't think you can do them separately. Right. So the last time we did a comprehensive tax overhaul in 1986, it was the second half of Reagan's second term, so that would be a potential precedent. But they had bipartisan cooperation between the White House and then Bob Packwood in the Senate as chair of the Senate Finance Committee and Dan Rostenkowski in the House as chair of House Ways and Means. And both parties had something to gain through this process. And I think we don't see clearly here politically what the Republicans and the Democrats both gain. And in 86, they also did corporate and individual at the same time. And the way they made the tax code what's called revenue neutral, which means they got to come out and claim that they didn't overall raise taxes, they didn't raise the total amount, at least on the Green Visor calculations, the amount of tax revenue the government was going to get, is they raised an additional $200 billion from the corporate side of the tax code. And that's how they lowered individual income rates. That's how they lowered taxes for voters. So if you do corporate tax reform first, and right now there is this consensus, for what it's worth, among Republicans and Democrats that corporate tax rates and revenue should be lower, not higher, right? So you're going to move in the opposite direction than you did in 86. You're going to try to have less revenue coming from the corporate side of the code. So if you do that first, that means when it comes time to do the individual side of the tax code, if you want to keep revenue flat across both halves of the tax code, you're going to have to take more money from individual taxpayers, including small businesses. So that, to me, is always the sticking point of, oh, well, we have this consensus on corporate tax reform. Let's do that first. That's a great talking point. I don't think they're ever actually going to do them separately.
And by corporate tax reform, the rhetoric on both sides seems to be eliminate loopholes but lower the rate, essentially. So it's fairer, you know, but lower.
More competitive with the rest of the world, change the tax structure territorial worldwide, make it so that you can't be stashing money, mm-hmm. stashing revenue overseas. But, right. So they're gonna need to – the reason to do corporate tax reform is to – take less money from corporations on tax day.
So much to look forward to. Well, here in the Bay Area and in California, of course, we like to lard up our ballots with propositions. And we've talked about these in the last couple programs, those of you who've been here for the last couple months. And just before this program, I was talking with even more people who are just throwing up their hands, not sure about the dueling ballots, the dueling propositions that tell you just the opposite of what the other proposition is. But I think we've all seen, maybe if we can talk about some of the most important ones or the most noteworthy ones, ones that you think actually will be changing some things. What ones would you list, whether it's local ones or statewide ones, that we've got on this ballot? Josh?
Well, statewide, I think Jerry Brown's going to get his wish. I think voters are going to approve both Prop 1 and 2. Prop 1 is the $7.5 billion water bond, water storage projects and stuff. I think water is on people's minds given our drought situation. This infrastructure won't be built in time to help us with this drought, but there's a logic that perhaps we could be better prepared for the future if we do this. And I think there's been a compelling argument that the parties came together in the legislature and agreed on that, which is a rare and wonderful moment in Sacramento, so you've got that. And Prop 2 is to essentially beef up the state budget's rainy day fund. Again, a bipartisan agreement that Jerry was able to broker in the legislature. Not doing quite as well as Prop 1 in the polls, but probably still going to pull it out. I would think both Prop 45 and 46, 45 to give authority to the insurance commissioner to reject unjustified health insurance rate hikes, and 46, which the operative part would raise the 38-year-old cap on medical malpractice damages in lawsuits here, which has been stuck at $250,000 since the 70s. I think both of those are going to fail miserably, if only because the insurance industry has spent something on the order of $100+ million to defeat them. Those are the ads you're seeing all the time on television, in your mailbox, it's been a full blitz against both of those, and I can't see either one overcoming it. 47 is the sentencing, criminal justice reform, pretty widely supported, probably going to pass. 48, Indian gaming, I don't know, you tell me. What are we going to see?
What did your poll say on 47?
We didn't poll on 47. We polled on 45 and 46, and we found voters very split on this, but our findings are consistent with what Field Poll came out with just this last week, which was that there had been a shift to the no, and certainly our poll results are laid the groundwork for that.
And Prop 1 and 2?
Prop 1 and 2, bare majorities, but majorities, okay. Yeah. So I expect passage on 1 and 2.
So 47 will be an interesting one to watch, because that could be, it changes how three strikes work so that more inmates would be let out, and it would be retroactive in how that worked. I've been a huge critic of federal mandatory minimum sentences. I don't know how many more inmates we're supposed to let out of California prisons. I can't vote for this.
Really?
And, yeah, we've let out so many. And the, you know, you hear the stories about some of the inmates we've gotten out that car thieves don't expect to really do any time anymore in certain cities. And so I think I'm not so sure Prop 47 passes. I know what you're saying, and I know that there are a lot of people on the right who believe, and the whole right on crime movement, with which I agree. Mm-hmm. But there have just been so many people that have been let out under realignment. I'm not so sure it's going to pass.
I just don't feel like there's been enough of a visible and audible groundswell against it.
That's right. The rule of propositions is it's always easier to vote no. Mm-hmm. So it's always easier for somebody to say, if you're not sure, you vote no. So that's the one. That's the only thing, in a sense, going that, in the fact that people may feel what I was talking about, but it won't be because of editorial page endorsements.
No.
The money is all yes on 47. You can see George Gascon on TV.
Yes on it because.
Because, well, he's the rare district attorney in California who is behind it, but most of the DAs are against it because they're worried that somebody who steals a gun. This changes whether or not it's a wobbler to a misdemeanor, and also date rape drugs. You know, if you have a date rape drug, you don't keep it for your own use, right? Because you don't want to pass out. It would change the penalties for that. So, I mean, but you're right. There's barely a campaign against it.
I just want to interject local measures. You've got the soda taxes in San Francisco and Berkeley, and that's a fascinating fight. The beverage industry, the soda industry, has put a tremendous amount of money into defeating these measures. The argument for them being that soda consumption is a huge driver of obesity and by extension diabetes, and so has huge public health costs. It's been sort of a lopsided battle with all of that money coming in from the American Beverage Association. So it'll be very interesting to see how voters in the two cities go on that. Richmond rejected such a tax a couple of years ago.
Well, in San Francisco, it has to get 2/3 of the vote. Is that correct?
Right.
Do you think that's possible? Anyone who's been following that one?
You know, when Scott Wiener came in to talk to the Chronicle editorial board about it, I remember just thinking, don't you have anything better to do? I mean, there are so many problems in this city, and you come up with this soda tax idea. You know, San Francisco voters, I may disagree with them politically. There aren't many Republicans in office. But they do have a common sense streak, and I don't think it's going to make it.
Yeah. Supervisor Wiener was, in fact, on this very stage on Friday talking about it.
So, Josh, I have to take the opportunity to thank Deborah for giving me the opportunity to plug the Hoover Golden State Poll, and I didn't use the name of it before, so this is kind of like my watch Wednesdays at 9 p.m. So the Hoover Institution, in conjunction with a partnership with YouGov, a survey research firm, has been doing a quarterly poll of California. So we're now in the mix with Field and PPIC. So those are the poll numbers that I was referring to.
Someone from the audience says, please speak more about Proposition 1. There are so many good aspects for conserving and protecting our potable water supply, but I am adamantly opposed to new reservoirs. Is this the kind of thing where when people kind of get into it, they might like the goal but not the execution of it?
Yeah, there have been several environmental groups and fishery groups especially that are dead set against it, but they've pretty much been, in a political perspective, they've been pretty much shouted down. Again, you got bipartisan support and some of the larger environmental organizations saying that this is okay. Yeah, I mean, what to do with water in California is always a sticky situation. It's semi-miraculous that we finally got bipartisan agreement on a water bond at all for that very reason. And there's still a lot of questions as to above-ground storage or, you know, whether or not this bond in some way obliquely enables Jerry Brown's twin tunnel plan for the Delta. And you know, it's there are always two sides to the story, but I think this is going to become the roadmap going forward. I think it's going
to
pass.
This might sound like an odd place to bring this up, but because it's been voted on in the state before and perhaps in the future, have you been following the story of Brittany Maynard? The young woman who decided what actually was she suffering from? That was the
glioblastoma.
And that's a terminal thing or just a
terminal brain cancer, an awful, awful illness. And she went to Oregon so that she could commit assisted suicide. She did that Saturday.
Okay. And Californians, we were talking about this beforehand, mm-hmm. actually have voted on that and rejected it. A resounding rejection? Was it a close vote?
It was, again, this is one of those issues, and Josh was talking about 47, mm-hmm. where I think there was sort of a lopsided money kind of thing.
Okay.
But what's interesting, just if you remove yourself, because this is a horrible story, she's 29 years old, adventurous, smart, married just like a couple years, and she seemed like a great person. I love her puppy. And she's the first millennial assisted suicide that we've had on the social media. And this is, I think, compassion and choice has really grabbed onto her. I'm against assisted suicide. I feel that the minute you start changing what the medical community, that once you make doctors into concierges so that you can have a death the way you want it, the whole idea, they call it death with dignity. The idea that it's not dignified to want to live, to go into hospice, I find that revolting. I know, I'm sure a number of people here disagree with me, but she is just what compassion and care wanted, because she's just this perfect fantasy, face for assisted suicide. She's not the sort of crazy neighbor down the hall who's all alone and doesn't have anybody to care for her. She's somebody who had all these people rooting for her, and I think that's the way we'd all like to think of how we would want to go.
Mm-hmm. This isn't anything that is before the legislature currently. Do you think this case, Josh and Tammy, do you think this case could inspire some legislation one way or the other? Or was this just
legislation or a ballot measure? I don't know.
You think so?
Probably by ballot measure, but it's a tough thing to sell. You know, on one hand, Californians like choices. You know, certainly the people to the liberal end of the spectrum like to have they like to have choice in things like abortion choice. They like to have choice in things like marijuana. Typically, stuff like that, and I think you could see a lot of people going for that. On the other hand, a big part of the liberal progressive bloc in this state also happens to be of religious backgrounds that would probably be dead set against this. Think about Catholic Latinos or Black churches, probably not going to be strong supporters of something like this. So even if you get libertarian Republicans on board with that, there's a strange cross-ideological bloc that would not be down with this. So it's a tough sell. You'd have to find some deep pockets to fund it, and you'd have to put it on the ballot at a time. Well, to fund in favor of it. The HMOs are going to fund
in
favor?
Yes, I do. I most certainly
so, so you would envision a showdown between the HMOs and the California Medical Association, maybe, pro and con? One would hope. You'd also want to be careful of when you put that on the ballot, because, what kind of turnout do you want, and you know, what kind of people do you want at the polls when you vote on an issue like this? You know, is it a better thing to have in the midterm? Is it a better thing to have in a presidential year? It's interesting calculus.
I'd wonder how California's proximity to the Oregon border could play into this. If Californians can also be convinced that you could, like
Brittany Maynard.
She did not live in the state of Oregon. She moved to Oregon to be able to...
From the Bay Area.
From the East Bay, yeah.
Oh, so there you go. will it just be the case that maybe folks will just start doing that more?
Okay. Right? That's a hell of a tourist trade.
Well, I do want to say, you know, you don't see a lot of people of color pushing assisted suicide. And that's because... It really is sort of a white affluent thing to be afraid that people are going to make you live longer than you want to. It is. I mean, and they're just, I mean, there are a lot of people in this world who aren't really afraid that people want to take too much care of them. So
I had raised the communities of color from more of a religious objection standpoint. I think dignity is sort of in the eye of the beholder. You know, of whether it's the ability to make that choice and end your life rather than suffer, or as you alluded to go to hospice and you know, fight the good fight and make the most of what you have left.
Refuse the care you don't want, which is your right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, obviously a very personal, very, very painful topic that we will be hearing more about. Let's move on to a much more peppy issue, and that is the economy, right? We all saw the news. The economy was actually had a pretty good quarter. The reason I bring that up is just because oftentimes when you're talking about elections, you'll hear commentators talk about, oh, well, you know, it's a, you know, whether it was a contract for America or Reagan, it was the economy. Bill Clinton, it's the economy, stupid. And I'm kind of interested, I mean, was this an election that had a national theme to it, or was it local issues? Tammy, what do you think?
Yeah, as Josh mentioned at the top of the roundtable, I think this is a classic midterm election where the president's party is going to get hammered. This is as close to a law as we get in political science. When it gets broken, which it rarely does, throws us into conniptions. But this is what you expect. It's especially what you anticipate in the second half of a second term. So I think it really is that as the underlying trend, and then it's been these race by race dynamics. Yeah. My husband actually asked me basically that question at the kitchen table the other day, and I gave him the, like, well, I think this is really a race by race election. He was like, that is not an answer. but I think that really it has been a race by race election with headwinds for Democrats.
Yeah. Can we use you're my focus group. How many people here think that the economy is getting better? Raise your hands. Okay. And how many people do not think it's getting better?
Yeah,
well, okay, but it's, but you know, that's okay, so obviously this is, people here think the economy is getting better, for sure. Yeah, okay, it's good to know.
I think that's partly a product of where we are. The economy has gotten better in the Bay Area.
Yeah, sure, it's great in the Bay
Area. Even if it's not better,
it's gotten better generally, but it's gotten better faster in the Bay Area.
Yeah, and you can see it even if your own personal circumstances haven't significantly improved, whereas I think there are lots of areas in the country where my mother just recently sold her home and moved into a smaller place. Her previous place, which she had owned for a few years, had gone down in value. Yeah. You know, so, yeah, I can see... Yes, the national economy figures might be good, but if you're not feeling it in Wisconsin and Kansas and some of the other places, that matters. Well, I do want to talk about some of the elections or some of the campaigns that perhaps haven't been talked about to death or that haven't gotten as much attention as some of these others. You know, we've all been talking about Jerry Brown and the Kashkari, and that's a very interesting race. But what are some races that you think are just interesting that maybe haven't gotten as much attention? Josh?
Two. One, local, Bay Area. We have a competitive Republican in the Bay Area running for the legislature in the East Bay, the 16th Assembly District. Catherine Baker, who's an attorney from Dublin, is running against the Democratic mayor of Dublin to succeed the termed-out Joan Buchanan in the Assembly. Very competitive race, very tight, a lot of resources put in on both sides. And it would be very interesting to see if for the first time in more than a decade we have a Republican lawmaker in the immediate Bay Area.
And what's she like? What type of Republican is she?
She's run a pretty moderate sort of platform. You know, she brings no significant baggage to the race other than the R after her name. Whereas Spranti, in the Bay Area, I'm saying that's baggage, you know, or else you'd see Republicans winning races. Spranti brings the baggage of having been the head of the California Teachers Association PAC for many years, and so the Republicans are basically hanging around his neck any objection that anyone has ever had to the teachers unions in this state, which are many.
But so. This is also the BART strike race, because originally Steve Glaser, a Democrat, he's Jerry Brown's guru, was running again. It was in the race too, and he basically was pushing to get into the legislature to pass legislation to disallow public transit strikes. And so Labor got really big behind Tim Sobrante, and Steve Glaser came in third. Top two, it could have been a Sobrante-Glaser race. Mm-hmm. So we'll see if there's some hangover from the BART strike that affects this too.
Glaser had burned his bridges to the unions and the party already before the BART strike thing ever came up. You know, he did some consulting work on behalf of candidates that took out some more liberal members of the legislature elsewhere in the state. So there was no love lost there to start with. But certainly the BART strike situation did not help him. And brought the wrath of the unions down upon him in full force. The other race I just wanted to mention briefly, nationally speaking, is the Senate race in Kansas is just fascinating to me. This is the race where the Democrat dropped out at the beginning of September because they realized that this independent had a better chance of unseating the Republican incumbent. And it is a tight race. And, you know, this independent is expected to caucus with the Democrats should he be elected. So it's sort of like a proxy race in some ways, but it's been very interesting to watch. Kansas, you know, has long been identified, for better or worse, as sort of ground zero of conservative Republicanism. What's the matter with Kansas? The Tom Frank book, many of you probably know of. So I'm dying to see what happens with that race. It's going to be really interesting.
He's been coy enough about the caucusing question, though, that I would guess that he just is going to do what makes him more powerful if he manages to be elected. So he'll look and see what the majority control of the chamber is, and he will caucus accordingly.
Now, that's one of the reasons I'm not quite willing to be so sure the Republicans are going to win because of Pat Roberts. Mm-hmm. Here's this guy should not have run for re-election. And he's just been there too long. And after this debate, one of his aides told the press that after the debate they were going to go home to Washington.
Go home.
Like, not Kansas, right? I mean, he's just totally not a good candidate. Yeah. I think the big thing to watch here in California is the state schools chief race.
Yeah. Someone, in fact, just asked about that. What do you think?
Who asked that?
Good question.
10 points. 10 points. because that's really now they're tied in most of the polls you're looking at, and I think that means that Tom Torlakson wins because Marshall Tuck has run this amazing campaign, and the big issue he's campaigning on is the Vergara decision, which basically finds teacher tenure is, thank you so much, unconstitutional. And he's mad at the governor, and he's mad at Torlakson for appealing that judge's ruling. And he's really playing this well. He's young, he's energetic, he's sort of the disruption Democrat this year. But if it's a low turnout, the teachers' unions will have the organization going for them. And Tom Torlakson's their guy.
There's been huge independent spending in that race. The teachers' unions on behalf of Torlakson. And there's a committee that's funded in large part by William Bloomfield, who's a Southern California real estate billionaire, and Eli Broad and a couple of other, I think some of the Waltons have given money to that committee, who's supporting Tuck as well. So there's a huge and very nasty, independently funded ad campaign going back and forth in that. It's interesting to watch.
Now, I would bet that this is going to be a very low turnout election in California historically. Yeah. Okay, we've got a governor who's pretty much been mailing in this re-election campaign. We have ballot props that haven't generated the heat that we've seen in recent elections, and I mean certainly not in 2012, where $372 million got spent on the ballot props alone. And so I think that when you bring up teachers' unions, I think that those are the kind of things that are going to decide this particular election. We saw in our Hoover Golden State poll, and Field is picking this up as well, that there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty among voters about the propositions, even among voters who have chosen a candidate between Brown and Kashkari, so have dialed in at least to that extent. And so Deborah's exactly right. The rule of thumb is that people tend to vote no or for the status quo when they're unsure on a ballot prop. They also tend to stay home if they think that Governor Brown's going to win and they're not sure what to do about ballot props.
And when she says low, we're talking about century record-setting low. We're talking about less than 50% of registered voters and only about a third of eligible voters in California.
California water table low.
Really low. Which means very few people are making the decisions that will, you know, affect the state for years to come.
Okay. Well, our gubernatorial race is a foregone conclusion. Tammy, talk about some of the other, there are some interesting governor's races across the country, right?
Yes, I think that the governor's races are where a lot of the action is. A race that's been getting a fair bit of attention, but probably not as much as it deserves, is the governor's race in Kansas, where as you might know, the Republican governor is running for re-election. Sam Brownback, and he pushed through significant tax cuts. And of course, his side of the story is that they have not yet had time to take effect. And the other side of the story is that they've blown a giant hole in the state's budget.
Closing schools all over the place.
So bad that it has prompted dozens, if not more than 100, depending on how you count, prominent Republican politicians in the state of Kansas to come out and endorse the Democratic challenger against him. So that is interesting race for the Republican Civil War, but also thinking about what that means for Republicans moving forward about their stance on tax policy and supply-side economics. I see the counterpart to that race in terms of the inverse of attention, low attention, and also not the same tax policy promoted by the governor as happening in Ohio, where the Republican incumbent governor, John Kasich, is going to just blow that thing out of the water. I mean, I would expect that he will win, certainly by double digits, maybe Jerry Brown style, by 20-plus points. And then the question is, what does that mean for his plans for 2016? And even if he decides not to run, what lessons could potentially other Republican candidates take away from that race? Kasich has been much more moderate in his policy stances. He embraced the Obamacare Medicaid expansion. He has been tacking to the right on some social issues, which has been a turn for him. So I'll be following that closely, but I think that those are our two governor's races. And then I also have my eye on New Mexico, where Susana Martinez is almost certainly going to get reelected, and she is a potential shining star for the Republicans because, aside from being a good governor, she also addresses their Hispanic problem.
Deborah, how much money would you give to have been able to cover the Florida gubernatorial debate?
Oh, I'm so angry.
Would you like a fan?
I'm so angry about this. So you guys saw that the debate where Scott Walker would not appear on stage for 7 minutes.
Not
Rick Scott. I'm sorry. Okay. Rick Scott wouldn't appear because he didn't like the fact that Charlie Crist had his little fan, so he wasn't there, and I'm envious because, you know, this is a really crappy state to cover the election, the 2014 election from. All these other states have these really sexy fights, and there's a lot of money and mudslinging.
And we've got superintendent of public instruction.
But it's like Jerry Brown's meditating, right? He's not even running.
Campaigns without campaigning.
That's it. He's hardly made any campaign appearances. He's hardly doing any ads. And there's one debate between Jerry Brown and Neil Kashkari, and Neil Kashkari's trying to get some, you know, excitement going. So he starts fighting with Jerry Brown because the rules for this debate, and by the way, the press can't even see it. We actually all have to watch it from a TV screen because it's in this little TV studio in the Senator Hotel, and he's and the rules were that he can't move. So for like a whole half day, they're calling around saying Neel Kashkari is going to boycott the debate, but he didn't. He showed up, so there's like no story. And then, of course, I mean, the debate had a couple moments, and it says something about politics in this state that people actually congratulate Jerry Brown, like it's an amazing thing he deigned to debate Neel Kashkari. We don't expect our candidates to debate anymore. And isn't that just sort of sad that we actually, oh, yeah, you're a Democrat, it's yours, you don't even have to talk. And I'm one of the people who has to credit Jerry Brown for doing the debate too, because he didn't have to.
Gavin didn't. Kamala didn't.
That's right. None of them. That's right. Dave Jones, did he do anything with Ted Gaines?
Would anybody have shown up if they did? There were some. I think there were several debates actually, though, between Alex Padilla and Pete Peterson for Secretary of State. That was an interesting race.
And Pete Peterson, the Republican, has a chance. So does Fresno Mayor Ashley Swearingen, who's running for controller. It's like not totally hopeless, which is huge for me.
So they're in single digits.
But you know, the other. Let's talk about what's so interesting about this is the reason this election is so boring is it's one party rule, and everybody knows what the outcome is going to be. And there's no money this time because Neel Kashkari is like a poor millionaire Republican.
Yes, he was only able to put $3 million.
He was only able to put $3 million. By the time this election's over, I'm going to have more money in my 401k. Right? And so everybody complains about elections, about the mudslinging and the money. But the truth is, that's what gets people interested enough to vote. Scotland, everybody voted on that referendum. But here, everybody agrees, and it's kumbaya. And we're going to have a turnout below 50%.
Did you see the story just recently? Alaska, I believe, sent out letters to everybody showing their voting record and their neighbor's voting record. Is that good or bad? What do you think?
Voting record meaning not who they voted for,
voted. Just whether they had voted.
380,000 Californians voted for Leland Yee for Secretary of State in June. After he was indicted. And had dropped out of the race.
That's because they're all gun runners from.
He did not come in last in that race. There are a bunch of people who finished behind him.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, some quick ones then maybe before we move on to the next topic. Oakland's mayor, Gene Kwan, going to pull it out, or are we looking at a change of power there?
I don't think so. I think we'll probably see one of two city council women as the next mayor, either Rebecca Kaplan or Libby Schaff. Rebecca Kaplan, long time, sort of progressive, pretty progressive, but you know, still seen as something of a City Hall insider now, given her time on council. Libby Schaff, a little bit more toward the moderate side, still pretty progressive, endorsed by Jerry Brown, and her numbers really took off when that happened at the beginning of last month. So, but 15 candidates, plus a dog, plus a guy who bought billboards encouraging people to write him in. So 15 wasn't enough, apparently. You know, we had to have another. No. Ranked choice voting makes it very hard to predict in Oakland, though. So we'll have to see what happens.
I have no idea.
Okay. Any thoughts on San Jose? They have a mayoral race as well. Mayor's race as well.
I'm not sure.
Crime is the big issue for them now.
Police staffing and crime. Sam Liccardo and Dave Cortese facing off for that job. I'm not sure what the polling is, we'll be watching carefully to see what happens there.
One last quick one. What will Governor Brown do with all of his unspent campaign funds?
He'll give it to the military charter school in
Oakland. To Oakland Military Institute?
Is that the one he set up started in Oakland?
I think some of it may go to future ballot measure campaigns or maybe back to the party. He can fund candidates or campaigns.
Does he run for president?
No, I don't think so. But he keeps saying no.
Yeah.
But you know that never really means anything, right? But I think his wife would kick him in the butt if he He made some noises when he filed his candidacy papers for this race. Mm-hmm. Somebody said, "Oh, how does it feel to be filing for your last campaign?" He said, "Who said it was going to be my last campaign?"
He wants to be Oakland mayor again. He said he wants to run for Oakland mayor again.
Not exactly what he said. What he said was, when we asked him, "Well, what would you run for?" He said, "Well, I was just over at Oakland City Hall, and I love the energy there." So it's like, oh God. It's like, you know, maybe he'll run for something. I don't think he's going to run for president, though.
I just would never count him out on that.
Well,
he looks in the mirror and he sees the president.
Yeah, well, we'll see. He's tried three times?
Yes.
Okay. Yep. Well, we have not had enough controversy on this program today, so let's talk about Bill Maher. And this is a story that has if you don't know, you'll find out, has a local angle. He's an outspoken comedian. He got into an argument a few weeks ago on his HBO program, Real Time, in which he disagreed over how widespread certain views are among the world's Muslims. He was arguing with noted political genius Ben Affleck. Actually, it wasn't an insult. I'm sorry. I was taking a pot shot at the fact that he was an actor. But, hey, Bill Maher's a comedian. Following this program, of course, then Maher continued to defend his position. And basically, that he was criticizing polls that were showing, or highlighting polls that were showing, large numbers of Muslims in various countries who, for example, supported the death of apostates to the faith, that it was an okay, you know, that should happen. Whereas his critics were saying, hey, you're tarring an entire religion with the views of some. So, enter UC Berkeley. He was invited to address the mid-year commencement ceremony at the University of California, Berkeley. Then more than 4,000 students, is that right, signed a petition?
We don't know if they're students.
Okay. More than 4,000
people,
and maybe the dog in Oakland, signed a position, though, at petition, excuse me, calling for him to be uninvited, disinvited, de-invited, whatever, but he has not been. So, Deborah, you actually wrote about this recently. Do you want to tell us a bit more about it?
Yeah, this is one of those instances where I had a column written, it was up on the gate, and all of a sudden there's an announcement, and I had to rewrite it in, like, half an hour. What happened is the Californians, which is the student group that decides who will do commencements, they actually caved and disinvited him. They rescinded the invitation. What kind of a universe is it when students are in the university actually said, no, he's coming? So you have this weird situation where a group of students are saying, we don't want the foul-mouthed anti-religion comic to come here. He's too argumentative. We don't want him in the administration of a university. I'm sorry, this just isn't supposed to happen. In Bergenau, the previous chancellor, he had been invited to a university back east, and when people wanted to protest him because he put some people in jail because they broke the law when they were doing protests for Occupy, he backed out. We're used to seeing administrators cave. We're used to seeing them say they're not going to cave and then caving. But this new chancellor said, nope, he's coming. You cannot disinvite him because he has used his First Amendment rights. And my hats are off to this new chancellor.
Yeah. It's
just amazing.
Well, it's interesting because there were some of the people, I believe, I don't know if it was in your column or elsewhere, were some of these students, petition signers, who actually said that they wanted him disinvited in order to protect free speech.
They're supposed to protect, the university is supposed to protect us from people like him. And what happened to the free exchange of ideas?
I thought
universities, you mix things up, you're exposed to different ideas. And
well, we had this same brouhaha over the same set of issues last commencement season when... and I'm sorry, I'm blanking on her name.
Ayaan Hirsi Ali.
Thank you. Yes, yeah. For disinvited. Well, she eventually backs out.
No. They were sent. Brandeis was going to give her an honorary degree, and then took it back, and then told her, "No, we're not going to."
Oh.
And then there's also Christine Lagarde.
Yeah. Yep.
The International Monetary Fund.
Yeah.
President.
And right, because we all know how horrible the IMF is. and then Bergenau, and mm-hmm. Was there one other person? They call it the disinvitation
Condoleezza
season.
Condoleezza Rice, it's happened to.
Condi Rice was somebody, and she said, I don't want to be the issue, and she backed out.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah,
Bill Maher has a show to do. He wants to be the issue.
He does. This Bill Maher couldn't be happier, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
But and I'm not a big Bill Maher fan, but when students decide that they want the university to protect them from ideas, that's not a good thing.
When I was in school, late 80s, early 90s, there was the whole hate speech movement, and universities were instituting rules that if you said, wrote, did certain things, they were going to be pretty aggressive about kicking you out. And I remember at the time, I got some rotten letters, it was before email, because what I was saying was, this is a university, this is the University of Wisconsin, one of the great public universities in the world. They can teach you to make a nuclear weapon, they can teach you the history of the world, but they're saying if you've got these abhorrent views, we don't know how to deal with you. We apparently, and all of these Nobel Prize winners and other geniuses here, we can't convince you otherwise, therefore. And that just, to me, kind of seemed the university saying, we're not really a university anymore, we're a trade school.
Mm-hmm. And I find Bill Maher to be a particularly interesting case because he was invited in the first place because he does things like this.
Yeah.
And because he says things like this. And then for him to actually do this yet again and then get uninvited seems to me to... Do they have amnesia about how he got the phone call in the first place?
Yeah. Well, one last thing then, I guess, before we move on to our news quiz. And that is, I wanted to talk a little bit about the aftermath, if you will, of the upheaval in Ferguson, Missouri. Remember the case there that happened, the African-American male, was he a teenager or he was a young adult? 18? Okay.
Both.
A teenager, but of the age of majority.
Okay. Young adult.
Old enough to vote.
Right.
Not old enough to buy cigarettes.
Yes, killed by a police officer. It sparked a lot of protests. For a while, it was the main news story pretty much everywhere. It's no longer the main news story on whatever newspapers or websites or whatever you're going to. However, it has spawned, of course, a lot of continuing discussion, including a very large one the Commonwealth Club held recently. One of the things we did not see much of was the nation's first African-American president didn't go there. He made some statements, but I mean, he's been criticized by a number of folks on the left about this as basically being AWOL on this. And is that just he is a more cautious president than some folks have wanted? Or, I mean, what happened? I mean, wouldn't you expect that he would have something really significant to say about this? As both a president and a father and
well, he did have the Justice Department look into it. I think I just saw something. I think I may have just seen something this morning indicating that this the Justice Department is not going to pursue a civil rights case against the police officer who was involved in that shooting. I think there's a lot of political calculus to it, but I think it wasn't quite as clean a case to hang these issues of race and disparity and stuff on, as was the Trayvon Martin case, for instance, you know, which he did speak out a little bit more clearly about. I don't think it's necessarily that he doesn't care about these issues. I think he may have been sober enough to look at the actual circumstances and decide that this wasn't the one to make. Now, that's the case with the shooting itself, the case with the aftermath, with the police reaction to the protests, stuff like that. That's a different can of worms. I think you may still see some action and some blowback and some effect on that in terms of the, you know, I think it did sort of bring to a very fine point the debate that's been going on in this country about the militarization of police forces, the use of surplus military equipment, armored vehicles, and the like. And seeing a cop laying on top of one of these vehicles with a sniper scope, rifle aimed at a group of demonstrators was a very resonant image. I think that is may be more the legacy of what we see coming out of that case. So.
Okay. Well, folks, really, and I say this a number of times, but I really mean it. The other times I was lying. This time I mean it. Lots of really good questions here. And I'm sorry, we could go on for another hour if I were to get through them all. You're going to have to take them up on our social hour out there. Let's go to the news quiz. And if Fran, my prize giver, is here, I'm going to ask a question. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand. I'll call on you and say it out nice and loud. If you've got it right, Fran is going to deliver some Ghirardelli chocolate to your hands. So the first question, I try to get some questions in here. Some are easy, some are harder. Hopefully everyone's got a shot. So former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney predicted that if the GOP takes the Senate, it would pass what long-awaited legislation? Anyone see it? Raise your hands. Sir? Immigration, that's right. He also said possibly trade bills that they might be able to get something through. He's right in front of you. Oh, is there a tie? I'm sorry. Oh, you don't want it. Oh, okay. Very good. This is such an altruistic audience. I love everyone.
If only Washington could be a little more like this.
Yes.
This give is, the candy to them.
If Ted Cruz could see this, it might. Okay. Next question. Why did Egypt convict 8 men this week? Did you see this story? Sir?
A homosexual wedding.
That's right. They were videotaped attending a wedding party for 2 men. Staying in that part of the world, Iran sentenced to prison a 25-year-old woman for doing what? And your hand went right. She attended a men's volleyball game, actually, but we'll give it to you. Gentleman right there in the hat, which I'll just note is not a San Francisco Giants hat. But give him the chocolate anyway. Okay.
And the pasta.
Yes, apparently they had segregated, or they didn't segregate their sporting events. They actually forbid women from going there, of course, to protect them from men. That's their story, not mine. The National Transportation Safety Board said it could take up to a year to investigate what incident? In the back there. That's right, Spaceship Two, that's the Virgin Galactic spaceship that crashed, killed one pilot, and injured the other. It was a... He's wearing a San Francisco hat, thank you. European leaders said they would not recognize elections that were just held where? In the back, ma'am. That's right, in eastern Ukraine. The rebel areas, they held some... unofficial elections. Two Kenyans took top honors in what competition this week? Ma'am? That's right, the New York Marathon, right here in the second row.
Oh, you guys are cleaning up.
I know.
Second row. I
need the tougher questions here.
Absolutely killing it.
Yeah.
Okay, well, here's the candidate politician who keeps giving. Former senator and presidential candidate Rick Santorum warned that the United States could reach the level of religious persecution last seen when and where? Come on, it's the go-to era. Nobody? Want to guess, anyone? Raise your hand. Nope. Sorry? That's right, Nazi Germany.
No hyperbole there.
Okay, and... Fran, I need you to do some math. How many prizes are still in there? Sorry. 3? Okay, let's do these quickly. A United Nations climate panel said what should be phased out by the year 2100? I'm tempted,
yes,
but I'm going to...
That's
right, fossil fuels. Gentlemen, there, raise your hand so Fran can see you. Okay. This might be a tougher one. How did China Fashion Week help people who were dealing with Beijing's notorious smog? Did you see this story? Anyone want to guess? In the back? Sorry? No, that would have been effective. Sir? I'm going to give it to you. They actually had a fashion show with designer face masks.
So,
yes. So right here. And I believe for our last one... Sorry? 2 more? Okay. Then let's do one last one here. Mourners are paying respects to the late Tom Menino, the longtime former mayor of what city?
Austin.
You know what? You all win. We've got a reception out there, wine and food. Thank you all for coming. Thank you to our panel, Dr. Tammy Frisbee, Josh Richmond, Deborah J. Saunders. Thanks to all of you here in the audience, listening online and watching online. Have a great week.